Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when's the last time you wrote a letter to a friend or relative just because? Or you kept a journal or a diary? A therapist tells us why writing down the little details of our lives can have some surprising benefits. First, the Department of Public Instruction is asking for $60 million in new funding to pay for mental health services in Wisconsin schools. That announcement came yesterday, and today the Department of Justice says they have $45 million in leftover safety grant money that'll go in part towards mental health training for teachers and counselors. There's renewed attention on students' mental health concerns, and today we're taking a closer look. Linda Hall is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of Family and Children's Agencies. She's with us now to talk about mental health services for students. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for asking me to be on.
We've seen these announcements from a couple of state agencies now. Why are we seeing this renewed attention on funding for mental health services in Wisconsin schools?
Well, I think that we're hearing from teachers and from communities that children have mental health issues that need to be addressed, and they're looking for additional help with it. In particular, we know that our efforts to get funding for school mental health collaborative grants to bring providers, parents, and school personnel together to support kids. There was the grant program that was administered through DPI had a tremendous number of applications, and we were able in the last budget to get $3.25 million appropriated for this purpose, and the applications came in at over $8 million. So the schools are really asking for help to create the conditions that they can be more supportive to youth who are struggling with mental health issues.
Talk about what happens on the ground in a school. What kind of services are available that schools are asking for more of?
Well, schools have people, you know, in student services who help. So there are some school social workers, not enough. Wisconsin has fewer school social workers than the national average. There are some school psychologists who are able to do some work. But what teachers are telling us is that they're identifying more and more children who are coming to school with trauma, with other issues that they really can't quite deal with. And so what our member agencies of WAFCA do is to come bring in therapists to help with those students who have higher needs than are able to be addressed by the school personnel that already work on student services.
So can you talk about the funding called for now by the DPI? It's not a done deal. What would that money do in schools?
Well, the money would increase by tenfold the amount of money that would be available for schools that are developing or supporting a collaborative school mental health program. It would also provide funding so that more school social workers could be hired, and other professionals, school psychologists, that more of those people could be hired. This is a real issue because, as your listeners probably know, we have a shortage of mental health professionals throughout the state, and especially in some of the rural areas. Not only do we have that kind of a shortage, but many schools don't even have a social worker. So when kids come and present with some problems that are getting in the way of their studying, they need attention, and they present problems that are more than the teacher can deal with in the classroom. Without that basic attention to social emotional learning, so those are the underpinnings of what students need in order to be able to be successful academically, and that's what this is all about: is creating the conditions so that children can be freed up to address the academics and this learning that they're there to be about.
Talking to Linda Hall, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of Family and Children's Agencies, talking about mental health services for students in Wisconsin schools. Linda, you mentioned academic outcomes, academic performance. Can you talk about what happens to that student who has some kind of, as you say, trauma coming into the school, other mental health concerns? If they don't have that help in the school, what happens throughout their school career to their grades, to their performance, to their potential for graduation?
Their academics suffer tremendously. We know from programs that are already operating in Wisconsin that when children get treatment, that they get better, and their grades begin to improve. And when their grades improve, they're more likely to graduate, which then, again, makes them more employable and leads to them being more productive citizens. So we also know that when we invest in this kind of support for children, that it also reduces costs to schools because they need to spend less on discipline and those kinds of activities around that. So it's a win-win for everybody.
I want to bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Middleton. Steve, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Steve?
So I just wanted to say I'm really disappointed that your guest is leaving out school counselors. I'm the principal of a large Dane County middle school. The key people who support social emotional learning and benefit our students are also the counselors. And so we don't need to bring in counselors from outside agencies alone. We need to have counselors in the schools every day who know our students, have a relationship with our students. That's where the highest value is.
Steve, thanks for the call. Alinda, can you talk about the role of the school counselors, not just doing academic counseling, it sounds like?
Right. And Steve is right that counselors do play an important role. When therapists are brought into the schools, they are working with students who have been identified by school professionals as needing something more than what the school counselor can provide. So we're not trying to displace those people. We're trying to bring in supports for children who have more challenging needs, and the teachers need some support in working with those kids.
Right. Are we asking, thanks for that call, Steve, are we asking teachers and school counselors and principals and others to have this additional layer of expertise, mental health care provider, if we don't have those social workers and other services available?
Right. Teachers are dealing with the issues that kids bring into the classroom right now, and they are pretty overwhelmed right now with the variety of things that kids bring because their family may not have enough food. So there's food insecurity. They may not have stable housing. So there's a lot of things, pressures that kids are dealing with. And that comes out in behaviors and which can be, introverted behaviors or extroverted behaviors. And the teachers are trying to deal with that. So what we're trying to do is give them support, ideas on how to work with particular kids and support to be doing the best they can with the kids that are there. And what we're finding is that when teachers get that support and when the students get the mental health treatment, that they get better and classrooms move more smoothly. And as I said, it also can save money for the schools.
This is being presented in some cases as a school safety measure. Attorney General Schimmel says some of the grant money, would be used to create teams in schools that are trained to detect potential threats from students. Do you see this issue of mental health care access in schools as part of the school safety discussion?
Well, I know that that Attorney General Schimmel has proposed some new ideas. I haven't had a chance to study them, so I don't know the details about it. But I would say that we think it's really important to support kids and in supporting them through their academics and through their mental health needs, that this is just going to be better for everybody. And it will help everything go more smoothly at school. It will help kids relate to each other better, and it will help the school to be safe also.
Are you hopeful that the legislature will ultimately approve this new funding request for mental health service funding from the Department of Public Instruction?
Oh, definitely. Yes. We were active, as I mentioned earlier, we were active in seeking money in this regard, and we know that the need is so great. And we're very pleased that DPI is proposing to dramatically increase the amount of funding because we know that there are many schools out there who want to improve their programs or start new programs that will help students in their districts.
Linda, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That was Linda Hall, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of Family and Children's Agencies. She was talking to us about calls to increase mental health funding for schools in Wisconsin. Right now, lots of famous writers and thinkers over the years have kept and still keep journals and diaries. But our next guest says journals aren't just for deep thinkers and famous people. She says there are surprising benefits from keeping notes on our daily thoughts and activities, even the small stuff that we might take for granted. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you kept a journal or a diary in the past, maybe as a child? Do you do it now? What purpose did it serve, and what did it do for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Diane Barth is a New York City-based psychotherapist and author. We've talked to her in the past about her book, I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. Diane, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about your own journal keeping a little bit before we get into the wider benefits. What is it like? You've kept a journal for some time now. What's it like to go back and read through some of your old notes?
It's fascinating. And what I'm really excited about is that I found out that it's not just me who has these experiences. So I used to really avoid going back and reading my own journals. I have clients and other and people who I've talked to who use their journals for their, I have colleagues who write who use their journals for their writing. And I never would do that because I didn't want to go back and read what I had written. And then I started finding out that actually going back and reading it can be it can jog your memory about things that you don't even have any idea ever happened, and it can tell you things about yourself that are really valuable and nourishing, and also surprise you.
Yeah, what kind of things might surprise people about the benefits of keeping a journal or a diary?
Well, the surprises are kind of powerful. So one of the things is that there's some research. I'm not sure that I can't vouch for this particular research, but there's some research out of the University of Texas that says that it actually journaling actually boosts your immune system. What I can say is that journaling can, it does a bunch of things. It can get you thinking about things. It can work. You know, I'm as you said, I'm really interested in the whole idea of friendships, and sometimes we can say things in a journal that we can't tell anybody else. And it's not just that you get it out. It's also that you then have it in your own mind in a way that you can sometimes then talk about these things to other people. There's also some evidence that journaling releases stress. It helps you think about future behaviors. One of the things that I think is really interesting is that journaling is such a sort of generic term, but actually we journal in all sorts of ways. Some people keep a journal of their night dreams. Some people keep a journal of their daydreams. Some people keep a journal of, you know, what they eat and when they eat it and how they're feeling when they're eating it or not eating it. And some people keep a free-flowing, a free association journal. All of them are journaling, and they're all useful, and they're all really valuable.
Now, I don't journal, and I probably have the same objection to doing, the same obstacle that a lot of people do.
Yes.
What do I have to say? I don't have anything important to write down. Who cares? I don't care. So how do you overcome that kind of objection to convince people to give it a try?
Well, it's not that whether or not you have something important to say. It's that you have important things that you're thinking, and sometimes you don't even know that you're thinking about them. And sitting down and journaling is a way, if nothing else, of helping you start to pay attention to what you're thinking and have more of a handle on some of your thoughts. On top of that, in this day of tremendous stress and anxiety, I am finding that a lot of people find it just useful to journal to get out some of their anxiety.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lucas is with us in Superior. Lucas, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I'm 36 years old, and I've journaled probably since I was 18, 19 years old, and I get journals as, like, birthday presents because I'm so known to journal. But, like, I definitely second it. But, like, I do have a lot of anxiety and depression, and I write down political events or, like, you know, kind of, like, gossip or what said what. So, like, you know, like, I, you know, if something happened to Facebook and everything like that, you know, then something since someone will have a record of a person, you know, what person's life these days and everything like that. So thank you so much for talking about this.
Actually, Lucas, before you go, I want to ask you a question. You've been journaling a long time. Do you ever go back and read the old journals?
Oh, definitely. I used to write them in little notebooks, and now I kind of spend just a little bit more to have the leather bound notebooks and just have these very perfect notebooks and have a special time. Then I have to have some coffee or have a nice record playing and just have my own little journal time. So.
Fantastic.
And Lucas, during that journal time, you actually read what you've written or you write more?
I kind of do both. I'll write the day, what the weather is, where I'm at, you know, and some of that spring's poems and stuff like that. So they're definitely useful. So
thanks so much, Lucas. And that's a good way to do it. And I think you wrote this in a piece you wrote about journaling. Set aside a little time. It doesn't have to be a ton of time, but some regular time to get in contact with your journal.
Yes. And so for you, Rob, and for other people who are anxious or uncomfortable starting, I have a friend who is a playwright, and years and years ago he told me that when you want to journal or when you want to write anything, you need to find a time and sit down with a blank piece of paper. In those days, we had typewriters, so sit down with a typewriter. And I'll talk about actually computer versus handwriting in a second. But you sit down, blank piece of paper, and you write. You just start writing. And if you can't write anything, that's fine, but you sit there with the blank piece of paper in front of you. And he said, give yourself, 10 minutes to sit and look at the piece of paper. And he guaranteed that if you just sit there for 10 minutes every couple of days, you would start writing stuff. And I have found that to be completely true with myself and with students and with other people I've talked to. The other thing I was going to say is that some people say journaling only works if you do it by hand. And there's a piece of truth there in that apparently if you're using your hand to write, you especially if you're right-handed, but it apparently works either way, that the process of writing activates your left brain. And then it frees up your right brain to do the creative thinking. Your left brain is the logical brain. Your right brain is the more creative side. So there's a whole school of thought that says you really should journal the way Lucas journals. It sounds like doing it freehand in a notebook or any kind of piece of paper. I actually know one woman who writes on scrap paper. She has reams and reams and reams of scrap paper that she keeps as journals. But I have found that it can work also on your computer, on your word processor. The real goal here is to just get some words onto a written page somewhere.
Talking about the benefits of keeping a journal with psychotherapist Diane Barth. Back to your calls now. Irene is with us in Phillips. Irene, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, folks. This touches very close to home. I've kept a journal for many years. I'm in my 70s, by the way. And I also keep a gratitude journal. Once in a while, something really great happens, and I write that down. But keeping my journal relieves my stress, especially political events in Wisconsin and the nation. So that's a good outlet. But a wonderful thing that I found when cleaning out my grandmother's attic was my late aunt's journal that she wrote in her teens at a TB sanitarium when she was dying from TB. And that is priceless and it's cherished, and I will hold on to that forever because it gives me a glimpse of what life was like for her 100 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Irene, thanks. Great. Diane, where do you want to go with that? There's a lot there.
Well, in my blog on Psychology Today about journaling, I say that I started journaling when I was a young kid, and I had read The Diary of Anne Frank and was just so moved and disturbed by it and distressed by it. But I felt that her diary kept her alive and it clearly has in a way for generations and generations. I had the fantasy at the time, I'll admit my grandiosity that, you know, someday somebody would read my journals and would think the same, you know, would be, just like Irene did with her great aunt's journals, would have a connection to me and would be moved by something I had written. But I think many of us carry around fantasies like that, that somebody's going to read our journal and be impressed by it. I think a lot of us also have the exact opposite problem, which is that we're afraid that if we write something and somebody finds it or sees it, they're going to think terrible things about us, or they're going to think we're stupid, or how could we possibly have written that? So that is, for some of us, a real impediment to writing, and I think if that's the case, then you have to find a way to make sure that your journal is very, very private, and that, you know, if you need to, that you're going to have it destroyed before you die. But I think the reality is that the process of writing about an experience can just make that experience more manageable.
We'll leave it there. Diane, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. And maybe you'll start journaling, Rob.
Maybe I'll give it a shot. That's Diane Barth, New York City-based psychotherapist and author. She joined us today to talk about the benefits of keeping a journal. First, it shouldn't come as a surprise that people on the autism spectrum want a social circle of friends and colleagues like anyone else might. But when the first published report of autism came out more than 75 years ago, it described those with autism as, quote, happiest when left alone, end quote. That belief is still around, apparently, but many researchers and people with autism are pushing back on that idea. They say friendship and social connection are valuable for people with autism, but different communication styles can sometimes get in the way. And there are things those of us not on the autism spectrum can keep in mind to make sure we're being open and available to people who are. Monica Nishik is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a mental health clinician at UW Health. She's worked extensively with people with autism, anxiety, OCD, attachment concerns, and other conditions. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, in your work and your education, for that matter, is this an idea that comes up a lot, that people with autism, they don't really want those social connections?
Yeah, I think that there can be a lot of differences in how they communicate with people, or just they might have difficulties with social communication or making eye contact or talking about things or even starting conversations with other people. And so that might send the message that they're just not interested.
And apparently this was an academic belief when autism was first being described, that it's not just miscommunication, it's a lack of desire for social connection. But not true, though.
No, and I think the one thing to consider is that not everybody on the autism spectrum is the same, mm-hmm. just the same with people who describe themselves as neurotypical. So you certainly have people, you know, I have friends who aren't very interested in social interactions or hanging out with people. So you can find that in the community. But I think overall, they have the same desires and needs for human connection.
And it seems like people are working sort of from both ends, working with people with autism on reading social cues, and for people without autism to read the social cues of people with. Let's start on working with people with autism. What kind of things might they be doing to try to say, okay, what is the social cue I'm getting? How do I respond to this?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting idea, because when I first started working with people on the spectrum, I was kind of blown away at all of the things that we do socially that are kind of intuitive to us that we don't really think about. So I know that when I'm having a conversation with you, that maybe I shouldn't make eye contact for too long. I shouldn't just stare at you. I can also tell by your nonverbal cues, maybe if you're not interested in the topics that I'm talking about anymore, and I might kind of shift and talk about something else or ask you about your day. So I would definitely say that communication, both verbal and nonverbal, are some of the biggest difficulties, as well as reading other people's emotions and kind of those subtleties in communication.
Is this something, you know, as you say, we take it for granted, people who are neurotypical, I think is the commonly used phrase. Is this something that if you haven't picked that up, is it learnable? Is this something that people can pick up with some work?
Yeah, it definitely is. It requires, I mean, you have to look at all of the different steps that go into communication. And so sometimes I think that makes it a little difficult. So I've taught people how to make an appropriate amount of eye contact with others. I've worked with people on starting conversations and ending conversations appropriately. There's just a lot more steps or a lot more things that you have to think about.
We're talking to Monica Nishik from UW Health about communication between people on the autism spectrum and people who aren't on that autism spectrum, and how we can all read each other's cues a little bit better. Now, let's come at this from the other angle, and let's start with that one specific thing. You mentioned that often, not always, but often people on the autism spectrum avoid eye contact or don't feel comfortable with eye contact, and that is misread by people not on the spectrum as saying, oh, this person doesn't want to communicate. This person doesn't want to talk to me. That's fine. How could the rest of us look at that signal and maybe read it a little better?
I think the number one thing would be not to make assumptions about someone, and maybe to just ask them about their experiences being on the autism spectrum and how that interacts with them. Or what challenges that they might have because of that, or what strengths they might have because of that. But I think assumptions are kind of what gets us in trouble, and not asking questions. So I'd really encourage people to be curious. Or if someone that you're speaking to maybe pauses for a while or isn't responding to you, you know, maybe asking a follow-up question like, are you still thinking about that, or do you need some more time? And not to just assume that they're not interested.
Right. In our daily social interactions out in the world, we might well not know that we're talking to someone who, you know, I don't know if someone is on the autism spectrum or not just by interacting with them or talking with them. So how can we just, I guess, have a baseline assumption of like, okay, I'm not going to shut this down based on some of these cues?
Again, I think just not, you know, not making assumptions about who you're talking to. You can always ask questions, or you can lead the conversation. So if you feel like someone is maybe not being as open with you, then you can kind of take the lead and ask them like what they're up to or what some of their interests are.
And I don't want to paint too broad a brush. You mentioned earlier people on the autism spectrum, that might mean a lot of different things for different people. Can you talk about the diversity within what we're calling the autism spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, recently with the DSM-5, the diagnosis has kind of changed for autism spectrum disorders. And in a lot of ways, it became a lot more broad. And some ways it kind of narrowed it down a little bit. But yeah, you can have people who are on the spectrum who are nonverbal and maybe have a lot of like functional needs that they need to work on or need to get met. And then kind of, as you mentioned, you can have people that you would meet and you would have no idea that they were on the autism spectrum. So it can really be that wide or that varied.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Ruth on the line in Madison. Ruth, hi.
Hi. So I'm 65 years old, and I don't see where I would benefit from having an official diagnosis, but nothing else explains my life. And what happens to me is people will start finishing my sentences wrong. And then the more they say wrong, the more I feel like I have to explain the, you know, why it's not that. And then it just gets to be this pile of questions. And the more frustrated I get, the less access I have to my words. And so I want to just scream. And I see sometimes at the daycare where I work where the kids are just screaming, and the parents are acting like the child is angry. And I can tell you that child isn't angry. That child is frustrated. And I think that when a person perceives somebody else as angry, then their visceral reaction is hostile. And when they perceive that person as frustrated, their visceral reaction is more helpful. And my husband has learned that when I've lost my words and he can just see the expression on my face, he'll just say, "What is it that you need us to understand?" And then it brings me back to the first question that was what I wanted to answer in the first place, not that whole tangled pile of questions that, you know, are you this? Are you that? Is it this? Is it that? No, stop.
Ruth, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience, not, as she says, officially diagnosed, but a little bit self-diagnosed on the autistic spectrum. Is this a story you've encountered?
Yeah, I think that just goes back to patience and kind of asking, you know, like her husband does, like, what do you actually need or what are you actually asking me for? And especially with younger kids, they may not be able to verbalize what they actually need or what they actually want. And that doesn't just apply to people who are nonverbal and on the spectrum.
What's your advice for parents or teachers working with a child with autism who does have that trouble expressing their needs?
I think number one is trying to figure out what they are trying to communicate with you. So even if they are nonverbal, all behavior is communication. So most of us aren't just, you know, walking around being angry or being frustrated just for the heck of it. You know, there is a reason underlying that. And so, again, trying to be curious and trying to figure out why might they be responding this way and how can I teach them to communicate that to me in the future so I can help them.
Ruth, thanks again for calling in. We're talking to Monica Nishik, a mental health clinician at UW Health and licensed marriage and family therapist. She's with us to talk about ways to build connections and better communication between people who are on and off the autism spectrum. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you or someone you're close to on the autism spectrum? What should people listening know about the social experience of someone on the spectrum? And tell us about your relationships and how you build them. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how to bridge the social and communication gap between people on and off the autism spectrum. Monica Nishik is a mental health clinician at UW Health and a licensed family and marriage counselor. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and maybe your experiences. If you're on the spectrum, what's your experience like in building relationships with people? What works? What doesn't work? What frustrates you if someone close to you, a friend or family member, is on the autism spectrum? What did you learn about how to overcome some of those communication barriers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Monica, before we go back to our callers, are there social barriers that people on the autism spectrum might have that the rest of us might not think about?
Yeah, as I stated earlier, some of those social cues that kind of come to us intuitively, we don't really think about doing them. And so when you're interacting with someone or someone on the autism spectrum, they're also having to keep all of these things in their mind at once, right? Like, am I appropriately judging if this person is interested? Am I making eye contact? Have I been talking too long? I also think there can be, there isn't always, but there can be some limited interests with people with autism. And it might be harder to find natural social connections just in everyday life. You know, my interest might be some video games that no one at my school is interested in, for example.
Let's go back to our callers now. Russell is on the line in Wisconsin Rapids. Russell, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Russell?
Well, I'm an NT, a neurotypical. My wife, Amanda, she is previously diagnosed as Asperger's, which has now been termed just regular autism spectrum disorder, and our 13-year-old son is also on the spectrum. For my wife, when she's in a social interaction of any kind, it can become physically exhausting to her to try to understand the social cues, the niceties, the eye contact. And it is actually draining on her to where she needs time to recuperate afterward. For my son, he doesn't get the social cues either. And if you try to correct him, he becomes very frustrated, very angry with it because he knows he doesn't get it. But he thinks other people just accept it and move on.
Russell, thank you so much for sharing your family's story at 800-642-1234. He talked about it being physically exhausting. And Monica, I was thinking that when you were talking about how someone might have to think through every social cue. I mean, it's like me trying to dance and think, where is my arm? Where is my leg? Like having to concentrate that much in a social interaction. Tiring, right?
Yeah, definitely. And just to his point, too, about his son. So none of us really like receiving feedback. And so if you think about being on the spectrum and kind of constantly getting this feedback, because we need to have it because we need to understand what, you know, maybe where we messed up in a social interaction or maybe where we could use some help. But that would just be mentally exhausting for anyone.
Thanks a lot for that call, Russell. So how do you come up with a feedback method, I guess, especially for a young person that helps them develop these skills but doesn't get them ticked off all the time?
One really good method is actually using role play. And so I would do that a lot with the teenagers and young adults that I would work with, especially before they would go into something like a job situation or a work situation. So we would kind of take turns being each other and coaching each other. So I think the more practice you can have kind of outside of that actual social situation, the better.
Thanks again for the call, Russell. We'll go next to Jason in Wisconsin Dells. Jason, hi.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jason?
Well, I just wanted to thank you and your panelist, Monica, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I just want to thank you for bringing this to the attention and putting it on the radio and just sort of raising awareness. I have a 10-year-old son who's actually diagnosed at UW by Dr. Ayama, and I just want to say you're exactly right with, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with everything you said, how it can be exhausting, how, you know, they can't read the cues, and, you know, even talking to my own son, I have to, hey, kind of look me in the eye, bud, you know, just make sure I've got his attention. It's just, you know, certain situations can be, you know, physically taxing on him as well. I mean, everything that previous callers have said is pretty spot on, you know, just waiting in line, for example, at amusement parks and such, it just gets him wears him out. And I just wanted to thank you. I know this has kind of become a growing concern and, nationwide. I just wanted to, listening on the radio as I'm traveling, and I thought, well, I just want to call in and lend my support and say thank you for this.
Jason, thank you so much for sharing that. Do you, Monica, see more people being interested in talking about this, not just families with somebody on the autism spectrum, but in the general public?
Yeah, definitely. I think we can kind of argue if prevalence is increasing or if we're just getting better at diagnosing autism. But I think certainly you can kind of go out on the street and talk to anyone and they have a connection to someone with autism. And so just more awareness and more communication and the more that we can talk about it, the better.
Thanks again for that call, Jason, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about building bridges between people on and off the autism spectrum, overcoming some of the communication barriers that can come up on both sides of the conversation. And you can join in with your stories, your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Monica, let's take this into a school setting. What can families and schools do to work together to help prevent that kid on the autism spectrum from being or feeling isolated at school?
Yeah, well, this is certainly dependent, I think, on the age of the kid, but I've worked a lot with kids on creating stories about themselves, either in like PowerPoint presentations or just like little booklets. And those specifically tell teachers things that are difficult for them, any like underlying sensory, so like sound or sights or even touch issues that they might have. Sometimes kids really have a hard time with large groups of people. And so maybe being in a small classroom is something that would work for this kiddo. And so I think really helping the individual create their own plan is the biggest key to success.
And what would you want the other kids in the classroom? Let's take this like to early elementary school, the neurotypical kids to know about children with autism and how they can connect.
I think going back to kind of what I said earlier is that their behavior is just trying to use it as a way of communication. So, you know, even if it looks like they're having a hard time or, you know, they're becoming upset or aggressive or angry, that's just because they're trying to figure out how to understand their body and get their needs met. So I think, again, just teaching patience and curiosity to kids as much as we can.
I know there's a Sesame Street character, I can't think of her name, who's on the autism spectrum. Do you see that kind of a public attention making a difference for what kids are ready to encounter?
Yeah, definitely. And I think just in pop culture in general, we've started to bridge that gap a little bit better. There have been more characters like on that show Parenthood, and there's a show on Netflix that's really good as well. And I think just showing kind of that spectrum of autism again is really helpful.
I want to get back to your calls in just a minute. Do you see, let's go to Jonah now in Madison. Jonah, hi. Hi, what do you want to tell us about Jonah?
So, I am diagnosed with autism, and I would be on what people would call the upper end of the autism spectrum. So people necessarily interacting with me wouldn't necessarily know that I had autism just by, like, talking to me. I mean, my own family and me didn't even really know what was going on until I was about 10.
And now that you know, have things changed for you, Jonah?
Yes, very much. I have gotten help that I really, really, really appreciate and needed. And things have gotten a lot easier for me.
How so?
But, I've started to go to social skills classes, and I have also, like, just learned about things called hidden rules, which are, like, social cues that other people who don't have autism, like, automatically know, but, like, we autistic people have to figure them out.
All right, Jonah, thanks so much for calling and sharing your story. So giving that kind of help for someone like Jonah can make a big difference.
Yeah, and I think research has really improved, especially into working with kids who aren't really young. So working with school-age kids, teenagers, and into young adulthood. There's still, you know, now there's social skills programs for different age groups. They're not as many as I would like there to be, but I think that has really helped.
Jonah, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your story. In our last few minutes, Monica, leave us with a message for the neurotypical community. You can cover some of the ground we've covered already. What should we be thinking about?
Again, I think be patient, be curious. Ask questions specific to that person's experience and what they're going through. And, you know, just make sure that you're being as supportive as possible and not making assumptions about people on the spectrum.
We'll leave it there. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Monica Nishik, a licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health clinician at UW Health. She's been talking to us about building lines of communication, better lines of communication between people on and off the autism spectrum. Still time for you to share your story and your thoughts, maybe your experiences. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or share your story. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. If you are on the autism spectrum yourself, was there something that really helped you out overcoming some of those social barriers Monica was talking about? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. I'm marking two birthdays, sort of. One this month marks the 5-year anniversary of Central Time going on the air full time. Technically, the anniversary would have been the beginning of this month, but we got caught up in producing the show every day and forgot to celebrate. So belated happy birthday to Central Time and everybody who's been involved in producing it and listening to it. Also, today's my birthday, and to celebrate, I did this thing that was big on social media a few weeks back, where you're supposed to look at the Billboard Top 40 list for the week you were born and see what song was number one. And supposedly, this is supposed to tell you something significant about yourself. I don't know about that. So here is my rule. I'm going to look up the song and play whatever song it is. I was right on the cusp of Close to You by the Carpenters, but here's my real birth song. This is Central Time.